Meeting to order and open public hearing on House Bill 5022, Oregon Department of Forestry. We're going to change our schedule just a little bit. Normally we would bring up the department for a while and then for at least a portion of the hearing have public testimony today, and that's what we're scheduled to do. As you can see, I'm short of committee members today. Presently, and so what I would like to do is start the public testimony, and I've got some on the list, and then we'll bring the department up, and then hopefully we understand there's some more people coming in for public testimony later on, and we'll reopen it for public testimony. And if we don't get through everything today, we'll probably back up and bring you back in, the department back in, for more testimony on Monday. Hopefully we can get through it today, though. So first, I would like to call, and I'd like to bring you up at least two at a time, maybe three at a time, Dave Ivanhoff, are you? And I didn't say that quite right, did I? Ivanhoff?
Ivanhoff.
Okay. Rod Green and Craig Hanneman.
Good afternoon, Senator Messerly. My name is Dave Ivanhoff and members of the committee. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates. I'm also the current chair of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Yesterday, in a show of support for the department's budget, and in particular the fire protection aspect of that, the operating committee of OFIC arrived at the tail end of your meeting yesterday, and it was interesting to me that there was discussion relative to the Elliott and the HCP on the Elliott, and I have to admit I'm not personally familiar with the Elliott State Forest to the degree I am with the forest in Northwest Oregon, but Representative Krieger made some very probing comments and questions that are valid, and at your invitation to the public to testify on the issues around the department's programs, that's why I chose to come before you today, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
The Department of Forestry's Forest Management Plan for Northwest Oregon is a culmination of about 7 years of hard work, taking into account the different opinions of people about how these state lands should be managed. And in January of 2001, a final plan was approved that was the result of, again, a lot of different perspectives, and it was a compromise. It was a compromise that I don't think anybody fully endorsed, but nevertheless it was accepted. And at that point, implementation of that strategy came to pass. Unfortunately, the department's implementation strategies, in my view, are not in complete alignment with the strategic and tactical assumptions made in the Forest Management Plan. Indeed, the department retained Dr. John Sessions of Oregon State University to do a complex modeling exercise to estimate the amount of timber outputs and revenue flow that would be derived from the management of these lands. Subsequent to that, I've heard people express concerns that Dr. Sessions' work was somehow flawed, that faulty inventory information may have led to overestimates of the volume that is recoverable from these state lands. To look into this hard, the counties, forest trustland counties, retained an expert in forest modeling, a guy by the name of Mark Rasmussen from the consulting firm Mason, Bruce, and Girard, and he has essentially replicated what Dr. Sessions' model outputs would be. The net effect of the implementation plans are that the department's average 10-year harvest plan is about 100 million feet a year short of what Dr. Sessions modeled, and again what other experts in the industry say is recoverable from these lands. And this shortfall in volume would not come at the expense of the strategies and the goals embodied in the Forest Management Plan. The result of this shortfall in volume is about $30 million a year. Of that, about $10 or $11 million would go directly to the Department of Forestry. And it's my belief, as you all are dealing with this budget crisis in this state and how to fund programs like fire protection, to the extent through legislation some portion of that incremental revenue flow to the department could be directed towards programs like fire protection, it would certainly take a strain off the general fund budget. And by that, I'm not suggesting that there should be any change to the formula that the revenue flow would go to the counties, but certainly through the economies of scale, putting up incremental volume, the unit cost of that additional volume in preparation would not be as great. So I truly believe that an additional 100 million feet a year would not cost $10 or $11 million to put up. And to the extent it doesn't cost that, that money could be redirected into other department programs. I think that it was very interesting, the discussion around the HCP on the Elliott and the justification for an HCP. Dr. Buter, I heard just the very tail end of that, of his comments. But what's really interesting, we own forest land. Our company owns forest land in the state of Washington as well as Oregon. And I think it's pretty commonly held that when you look for marbled murrelets, you tend to find them. And it would seem to me that before the state enters into an onerous HCP on the Elliott, that maybe a review of the status of those population levels ought to be reviewed with the idea that maybe the murrelet doesn't even need to be listed any longer. On the Elliott State Forest, that's the extreme south end of the murrelet's range, and again, I think that ought to be done first and foremost. With respect to the HCP strategy, Representative Krieger made a very good point. He said that the department strategy to carry these forests to extended rotations is going to develop a lot of larger diameter trees if they are even harvested, which we are skeptical that some of the people in the environmental community would tolerate the harvest of those older age classes. But even if they are harvested, it's my strong belief that the value of that wood fiber grown to those older age classes is going to be less than smaller diameter trees harvested at a younger age. But in addition to that, you create the habitat that will attract the species that we're concerned about. It will necessitate an HCP on the North Coast, which in my view it's unnecessary to do at this time. Indeed, when you look at the aquatic and riparian strategies in the implementation plan relative to the assumptions made in Dr. Sessions' models, there's about 25% of the landscape out there that has no harvest activity on it at all because of the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NOAA now in this case, imposing, in my view, onerous aquatic and riparian strategies. We've had a significant return of coho salmon, which indicates to me that the population dynamics of coho are not tied to the habitat as much as they are to the ocean conditions. So why lock ourselves into an onerous 50-year HCP and unnecessarily sacrifice the resource potential from these lands? The Department of Forestry has already spent over $2 million trying to get an HCP, and we aren't there yet. At some point, you have to take a look at what is this costing the state. Is this a good business decision? In my view, it's not a good business decision right now because we're dealing with a much younger forest than other areas of the state. I guess, again, the announcement, very public announcement of the salmon anchor habitat strategies lead me to believe that those lands are going to be held to some standard that may impact timber production. I have no idea what that is, but 150,000 acres out of a 500,000 acres on the Tillamook, Astoria, and Forest Grove districts could even have a more dramatic impact on harvest levels than the 100 million feet that they're short already. I have no idea if that's the case or not. I guess in summary, the thing I'd like to leave you all with is that Oregon is on the verge of insolvency, as you well know. I believe it's irresponsible for us to mismanage our natural resources and not take advantage of the opportunities for economic development that can exist with the more responsible harvest levels on these state lands. And again, harvesting at Dr. Sessions' number of 279 million feet a year as opposed to the 179 that the department's doing, that extra 100 million feet a year will bring about $30 million to the Oregon economy year after year after year. and it will be done totally consistent with the goals and strategies that the department wants to implement on the lands. I guess the only other thing, in the interest of time, I'll leave you with some spreadsheets. What this spreadsheet does is it illustrates Hampton's employment statistics and the contribution to the overall economy. It illustrates the financial impact to Oregon as a result of this shortfall in annual volume. And at the bottom of the spreadsheet, there are some examples based on my 30 years as a forester managing Westside forests, why I believe Dr. Sessions' numbers are absolutely reasonable. And again, the expert from Mason, Bruce, and Girard has essentially validated Dr. Sessions' work. With that, I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Representative Morgan?
But extremely interesting testimony. Thank you very much for coming
here
today.
Thank you.
Mr. Green?
Chairman Messerly and members of the Ways and Means Committee. My name is Rod Green. I'm a logging manager for Lone Rock Timber Company. I'm a board member with Coos Forest Protective Association, Douglas Forest Protective Association, and also with the Emergency Fire Cost Committee. And I come today representing these boards as well as myself as a taxpayer. Like other landowners across the state, our landowners are quite concerned that with the 16.4% cut that's proposed under the governor's reduction plan, budget reduction plan, that the level of protection on our lands will be gravely impacted. And we feel that there may be a significant risk for loss, not only of the natural resources, but financial resources as well. I guess the gist of my comment would be embodied in a pay me now, pay me later scenario. And fire history has proven that when we aggressively attack fires, keep them small, that the cost is minimal and the loss is minimal. If we don't prepare ourselves well and those fires grow large, naturally the cost goes up and the resource damage is extensive. Oregon's districts are managed, and the ones that I'm associated with are associations. Those districts are managed by a board of directors. And the board of directors that I'm acquainted with over the years are very frugal people. They're no-nonsense, no-frills people. They are, in fact, in their board role, taxers who become taxees. In other words, the budget that they establish, they're paying in part for. And their assessment of cost are to the point. In the assessment of budgets, district budgets, a dollar cut for general fund monies from general fund monies equates to $3.18 a district budget cut due to the way that our funding is structured. For instance, on Douglas Forest Protective Association, in order to accomplish a $355,000 general fund cut, that district will suffer over $1 million loss to its budget. When you view that over the entire budget, why, that leaves us with great difficulty in order to provide a protection program that's at an adequate level. The magnitude of the reductions has an impact not only on just those personnel that would be there during fire season, but you'd be interested to know that DFPA, which protects 1.6 million acres, has 12 permanent employees. That's it. But the heart of the organization is our seasonal people who return year after year and whose training we rely on and whose experience we rely on. There's 15 of those people. They're dedicated to putting fire out. they're addicted to it. And but when we make these cuts, the area that I have no understanding in, but when we make these cuts, their ability to remain with us and come back faithfully year after year is reduced. And even now we know there's some that are seeking other employment because they see that there won't be an opportunity for their 10 months or 7 months of employment, whatever we've had them down for. And what that means when we have a fire is there's none of that overhead management to manage the forces that we hire on a seasonal basis. And so our structure is gone and our effectiveness is gone. The forest landowners in our counties cannot purchase insurance for their crop. The only insurance that landowners have, and I was reminded of this by some of our small woodland owners, the only insurance they have for the entire family heritage is that it's afforded through a good, well-integrated forest protection program. We are their insurance policy. I think some of the losses that we see and we can immediately identify overlook some of the losses that I expect to see in the coming year. With a limited amount of resources, I know that the districts will have a tendency to be very, very conservative on fire season. And so the wages of our woods workers will be reduced because there will be fewer work days. If that eventually reaches the mill, there will be fewer mill positions available as they won't have raw material. And it's a spiral downward, I believe, as paychecks are smaller and tax revenues are smaller. Oregon's Department of Forestry has calculated the impacts of a $7.3 million budget reduction will result in a cost plus loss of $27 million annually. The Department of Forestry is unable to calculate the loss if a full $10.3 million reduction, as the governor's recommended, were enacted. It's apparent to me that the reduction of fire protection is not a reduction in true cost. It's going to cost us dearly. Aside from the general fund reductions, the current fuel loading that we have on our forest has not gone away. In fact, due to last year's fires, probably our risk and exposure is greater than ever. It's obvious that over the last 2 years, we've had the opportunity to use National Guard forces to assist us when we had severe fire incidents. It's apparent that this year they probably will not be available. The continued drought conditions and et cetera are going to leave us with at least a normal risk or greater than normal risk than we've experienced in the past, even when we had full funding to provide forces on the ground. The list of reductions speak for themselves. 10% loss of industrial fire program, 75% loss in aerial detection, 45% loss in lookouts, 10% loss in engines, 28% loss in dozers, 22% loss in seasonal positions, 18% loss in fire overhead, 18% loss in fire investigators. On behalf of the forest landowners, I want you to know that we acknowledge that you have a very difficult situation in handling this budget, and there are no easy answers. And my purpose in being here today was simply to offer a perspective that I hope might be useful as you deliberate on those which are truly cost savings as we deal with the budget issues. So I appreciate your efforts sincerely, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Is a priority in our discussions with the co-chairs, the ways and means of the leadership, that forest fire protection is simply not an option. That And as we go through this process, it's a very grave concern of ours, is how we can maintain the protection and the security in these programs as very best we can. So thank you very much, Representative.
Yes, I just wanted to add to Rod, thank you for coming, and I really appreciate the time that the DFPA took with the Douglas County delegation to talk to us about these issues, and that was a very well done presentation. The part about your presentation I think that's very compelling is the pay now or pay later scenario, because I think that's clearly where we're at with this, that once we burn through the landowner assessment and the insurance policy, and we already know that we're going to be asking you to up the contribution to the landowner assessment piece, and that what we're going to end up paying for the insurance policy is going to be quite a chunk more than it was in the last biennium. But after we go through that, then it's a straight shot to the general fund. And if we don't have the readiness piece of this in place, then the probability that we're going to burn through those two funds is that much greater and head right into the general fund. So I do clearly understand what you're saying about the prudence of having that readiness piece in place, because it's going to be a lot cheaper to put those fires out when they're small than it is going to be to put them out if they get beyond the stage where you can deal with them in that kind of a way. And I also appreciate, and I know that you understand the incredible lose-lose situation that we're in the budget arena here in the Capitol this time, and that I mean, we had, I think, a real pointed and truthful discussion about the inability to keep this program whole, and that there is going to have to be some level of cuts in it just because of the reality of the fiscal situation that we address. And I just want you to know that it really meant a lot to me to gain an understanding of how creative you were being down on the ground level about how you applied the funds and how you were doing a lot of things to save money and try to have private industry take up the slack on some of the fire safety issues and the inspection issues and things like that. And all that's going to be real critical as we try to pull our way through this real tough economic time that we're in. And please be real assured that as we walk through this process, fire readiness is a huge, huge issue that we're discussing, and it's an issue that we're really pushing hard with the co-chairs right now.
I appreciate your interest and your very clear understanding. In fact, you stated it so much better than I do. Thank you.
Don't feel bad. It happens to us all the time. If you, sir, have anything in writing that we can copy, that'd be very good. We're getting more of our committee here all the time, so we're getting. Mr. Hanneman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members. Ray Wilkerson, I'm Craig Hanneman with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Ray Wilkerson couldn't be in two places at one time, so I will combine my comments with his remarks. Regarding House Bill 5022, we would like to very strongly and firmly express our support and respect for the Department of Forestry. Mr. Chairman, on Monday, you made some remarks about this being, in your opinion, perhaps one of the strongest and best of the state agencies, and we would echo those remarks absolutely. Throughout its history, the Department has pursued its primary mission, the protection of Oregon's forests from fire, in a manner that has brought the agency national recognition and worldwide recognition as well. This past fire year, I think there's one very compelling statistic, and that is that 44% of the fires that started on state protected land, yet those fires accounted for only 10% of the acres burned. That's the most recent indicator, I think, of the department's capacity to deal with fire suppression. The department carries out its second most important function, administration and enforcement of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, in an equally exemplary manner. It's even-handed implementation of this major regulatory program over the past three decades. The department has maintained the support of the forest landowner community, both big and small, despite the high costs of compliance that landowners have. This has been critical, I think, in the support that has been generated for the Act as a whole. Regarding the budget, we expect that the committee, this committee here, would agree that the top priority for this budget and one of the top priorities for the entire 03-05 state budget is to adequately fund and maintain the Protection from Fire program. Failure to fund this program, as just articulated, at its current service level would likely place both the forest landowners and the state at an unacceptable risk. An underfunded program would put our resources at risk and would also put the state general fund at risk due to the $10 million cap on landowner liability for the cost of suppressing major fires. We also urge the committee to continue the department's forest practices program as close as possible to the full funding level that you have right now. All landowners accept the cost of complying with the Act because the Act serves to maintain public confidence that public resources occurring in private forest land are being cared for. Such confidence is critical to our ability to continue to manage our lands efficiently and profitably and to continue to provide the jobs and products associated with such management. We'd also like to express support for the Department's Forestry Assistance Program. This means a lot to small landowners, but it does to large as well. In addition to service forestry, other important pieces of forestry assistance include the Insect and Disease Program and the administration of the Underproductive Forest Tax Credit Program. Mr. Eidenhoff made reference earlier to my last comment that I'd like to share with you, and that is the one area that we have concerns with the Department of Forestry and maybe would suggest that we feel they're heading down the wrong path. That involves the management of state-owned forest land, particularly in the northwest corner of the state. The state's current management plan, as Dave referenced, it differs dramatically from private forest land management practices in three important respects. They have longer harvest rotation periods. They have greatly expanded protection zones for streams and wildlife, and the pursuit of a multi-species habitat conservation plan with federal regulatory agencies. All three of these elements carry with them significant financial price tags for the state, schools, and the counties who are the principal beneficiaries of the timber sale revenues from these state lands. In our view, the benefits associated with this management approach do not come anywhere close to justifying the added costs and lost revenues, particularly in this grave and grim budget climate that you're dealing with. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for considering our views on House Bill 5022. Appreciate the very difficult challenge that you all face.
Thank you very much, Greg. Any questions from the committee or comments from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much. Next, I'd like to call Rex Storm and Chuck Bennett.
Mr. Lee and representatives, my name is Rex Storm. I'm a forest policy manager with Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem. I'm also a certified forester. I'm here on behalf of the 1,000 member companies of the association, also known as AOL. Much of Oregon's forest management is operated by member companies of AOL, which are engaged in the contract harvest, reforestation, thinning, road construction, resource maintenance, and fire suppression activities. I appreciate this opportunity to speak before you this morning, this afternoon, in support of House Bill 5022, funding no less than what is proposed. Furthermore, we urge that no further funding reductions occur to the Forest Practices Administration portion of the department budget. And I might also add that we agree with the testimony of the previous three speakers that you just heard from. But what I would like to do is emphasize our interest in the Forest Practices Administration. We strongly support the work of the Department of Forestry, and we ask that the agency be fully funded in the next biennium. AOL strongly supports and respects the exceptional ongoing work of the department in pursuit of its four primary missions. We're aware that fire protection, as you heard, Forest Practices Administration, forestry assistance, and, of course, state forest management. In particular, Forest Practices Administration and enforcement of the Oregon Forest Practices Act traditionally receives about 60% of its funds from the general fund. And AOL urges that no further reductions in this funding level, the current funding level or allocation, occur. There have already been dramatic general fund reductions that have occurred to the Forest Practices Administration in the current biennium. Through the Department of Forestry's trusted implementation of the Forest Practices Program over the past three decades, ODF has garnered the confidence and the support of the forest operators and landowners alike. The forest operator community is proud of our decades-long accomplishment of resource protection under the guidance of the Forest Practices Act, and each year, the Department of Forestry Forest Practices Division processes in the neighborhood of 18,000 to 20,000 harvest per operation notifications. Their workload is very significant. The Forest Practices Program can boast a 98% compliance rate for commercial forest operations, as reported in a recently completed Department of Forestry compliance monitoring study. This extraordinary level of compliance rate manifests that this successful and cooperative stewardship that is maintained by the group of operators, landowners, and the department. These three communities cooperate together to maintain the high compliance rate of the Forest Practices Act. And this results as a this is a result of aggressive work by forest practices foresters working for the department, educational programs, publications, meetings, on-site visits, discussions, all work that costs money and takes time and budget. Budget cuts have already reduced the ODF forest practices forester staffing level by more than 20%. The extraordinary rate of success for the Forest Practices Program happens despite the high cost of the compliance and the complicated nature of the Oregon Forest Practices Act and its rules. Operator and landowner support has been critical in the success of this important state law, and we feel that general fund reductions are on the threshold at present of critically jeopardizing the continued success in the Forest Practices Program. So, in closing, we urge the committee to consider our interests in House Bill 5022, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Comments, questions? Mr. Green, I just want to say that the compliance rate of the Oregon Forest Practices Act is truly amazing to me, and I'm sure that some folks would say that, well, the standards aren't high enough. But from my understanding, my experience with the department, I think it's much more what it shows is that you can enforce without and get compliance by education and working with people. That's really the bottom line. What we're trying to do is do a good job and not have sediment, maintain the water quality and all the things that go with that. I wish that some of our other departments that had regulatory authority could really pay more attention and be more effective in getting compliance and it much more efficiently. So I appreciate your comments in that regard.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Mr.
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I just want to assure you and the committee I'm not here to ask for a shift of Department of Forestry funds to K-12. I wanted to talk about a very narrow part of the activity.
I'm really glad to hear that.
I thought you would.
We have that on the record now.
We have it on the record now, yeah. I want to just speak specifically to management of the common school forest lands, and particularly the Elliott State Forest, and just a couple of remarks to follow up on comments I had on the budget for the Division of State Lands. We are asking that absolutely every strategy available be used to review increased income from the Elliott State Forest. In taking a look at the value of the asset at $850 million and the income coming off it at $10 million with a less than 1% return on investment, we couldn't think of anything other than perhaps putting it under a mattress that would result in less income from this valuable resource, and we're very, very concerned about it. I think that I want to just mention that we hope that during the next 2 years, we're going to be watching this very closely over the next couple of years to see if there is a way to take this valuable asset and turn it into some increased income for the Common School Fund, or we're going to begin asking, I think, very seriously why we continue to retain this asset other than for its scenic value. We're very concerned that with the report in Mr. Buter's evaluation of Oregon's Common School Forest Lands Management Status Update that indicates that a significant shift in management of the Elliott from intensive forest production toward protection and enhancement of wildlife habitat. A fine goal, but it has nothing to do with the fiduciary responsibility the trustees, the state of Oregon, has to the school children of the state of Oregon, which is to return income from these investments. And income is not scenery, habitat, wildlife. It is income. It is spendable. And we're just real concerned that that has been overlooked as part of the balance in this. So just wanted to let you know, again, we're really very concerned about the situation on the Elliott in terms of production. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Representative Morgan?
Mr. Bennett, we've discussed this at length, and I just want to let you know that it's great to see you in this forum, which isn't the place where we usually cross paths in this building at all. But I think that it is incredibly valuable that COSA is beginning to understand the dynamics that the environmental issues bring forward in terms of being able to support schools. And I would just like to make it real clear that between COSA and OSBA and the OEA, you have an incredible pressure group there. And you could, I think, if this was an issue that was taken on by the education community, we could actually get to a discussion of what's the base of this, which is to keep the harvest program out of the courts. And we need to have that discussion in the state of Oregon, because clearly we're at the place in the management of all the state lands where the revenue that we're generating is almost all offset by the expenses of generating the revenue. And we're at a place right now, I think you're entirely correct, where we've got to ask ourselves why we're doing what we're doing, because it's costing us about as much to do it as it is to the gains that we're getting out of it. And I think the spreadsheet that we got from the Division of State Lands very clearly demonstrated that the expenses of the programs are just a little bit behind the revenues of the programs, which isn't doing the school kids of Oregon any good at all, and it isn't doing the small towns in Oregon any good at all, and it isn't doing the state any good at all. And I really appreciate your sentiment that if we're just going to be looking at this land for its environmental benefits and not its social benefits and not its economic benefits, then we have to ask ourselves why we're in this game at all.
Thank you, Representative. That's absolutely true. Relative to these lands are for no other purpose, from our perspective as the beneficiaries, than to produce income for the Common School Fund. That's why they're there. That's why the state is trustees of these lands, is for that purpose, for present and future children of Oregon. And if the question was, is it harming the future children of Oregon by overcutting, we'd be in here with the same question. But this serious undercutting on these lands, I think, has to be addressed. The school children presently are being harmed by this strategy. So we're hoping, as time passes, we will bring our colleagues with us to the table on this, but I can assure you we're meeting with OSBA, OEA, all of the education groups. We're also meeting with other Western states representatives of education groups that are very concerned about this same issue in their states. This is an increasingly important issue for obvious reasons. There's declining revenue available in all of the states for K-12 education, and we're not going to leave any stone unturned or tree uncut if we can help it on this case.
Senator Morgan, follow-up.
Just a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I would just urge you, as these discussions take place, that let's be very clear that the lack of cut is based on the need to set land aside and not use it because of the environmental regulations and the threat of lawsuits, and that we've got to get past that place if we're ever going to get to the point where we can increase the cuts and be productive and not end up spinning out all of our time and energy and money in the court system.
Sure. Thank you, Representative. And certainly the beneficiaries have legal recourse in all of this as well, as you and I have discussed. I think the beneficiaries have to start looking at their rights in these situations as well.
I just can't miss this opportunity to also make the point, Mr. Bennett, that the comments you made about the state lands and the investment and the value of that investment also holds true for the private sector. And that is also another source for general funds to operate our schools and our communities and the entire system in the state of Oregon. So I would hope that that we can engage more of education communities and other folks in the community to realize the importance of these natural resources to our entire economy. And I just can't miss this opportunity, and I'm going to blame it on Representative Morgan for passing me a note that the motto of this committee is clear cut for kids. So
thank you, sir.
Senator Duke.
I'm not even sure I want to follow that one, actually. But I would encourage you, Chuck, and the folks you're working with to look beyond the Elliott. You talk a lot about stable funding for schools, and that's what the Timberlands, part of what they were intended to be. And you must not have eaten lunch. I was actually trying to eat lunch before I got to committee today and missed the testimony from Hampton, but if their numbers are correct, and I don't have any reason to think they're not, that's a one-year loss of $30 million, and you can do the percentages as to what percentage of that would have gone to the school districts in those three areas. And for some of them, that would have been enough to get them off the state school fund, which then frees up that much money to the state school fund and to the other school kids in the state. So.
Absolutely, Senator.
It's a broader issue.
Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I just wanted the record to reflect that note I passed you was not in my handwriting.
Oh. And you do not endorse that statement?
I didn't say that. But the other point I wanted to make, you made a point about private lands, but I think that the same holds true for federal lands, that there was a time in the state where the federal lands contributed a huge amount of money to the schools. And we're clearly not in that place anymore. And I know that when we sat in my office and we looked at that map on the wall of the ownership of the land in the state, that it became real apparent that if you can't have that land base in the productive land base, then not only do you miss out on the revenue that you generate to enrich the rural parts of the state, but you miss out on the piece of the distribution of funds that benefits schools. And so there's a real clear connection there on the federal lands to an interest that the education community has too.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much, both of you. Next, I'd like to call Wayne Nalon and Barrett Brown. You might want to either move over or pull that mic a little closer here so they can pick up here.
Politics makes strange.
They won't get far.
Somebody leave their keys up here?
They're right.
Oh, right. Okay. Are they for sale, right? Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Barrett Brown. I am here representing the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, and as a way of introduction, my wife and I grow timber on land in North Washington County, and I'm a member and former director of the Washington County Small Woodland Owners Association. Also, I've been riding motorcycles with my family on state lands for 37 years. Through that time, I've worked directly with ODF recreation staff, well, I guess probably for 20 years. And so I've had a chance to witness the changes that have occurred on the landscape as recreation funding has waxed and waned over the years, and some good and some very negative changes as various management efforts have disappeared and come back. And so I'm definitely testifying in support of the current bill and against further reduction in their staffing. Over the last 20 years also, I've been really involved in various public involvement processes that the Department of Forestry have put in place. And I guess largely what I'm advocating for is the continuation of those processes. I've been involved in the Tillamook Recreation Area Advisory Committee and their motorized subcommittee. And what I've been able to see, I can testify really about two opportunities I want to focus on today, and that's volunteer coordination efforts and the grant-seeking opportunities. Not only is this obviously the most productive timberland in the world, it also is unique, and it's really adjacent to uniquely adjacent to a huge population center. And so recreation demands on that land will only increase. And largely thanks to the department's outstanding public involvement processes, there's really a lot of community support for recreation components of the management plan. So as the interest in the use has grown, the volunteer base and the volunteer pool has grown, and there are a lot of dedicated people who are prepared to help the implementation of the recreation aspects of that plan, but the coordination, staffing and funding has not been able to keep pace with the pool of volunteers. I can speak from a broader perspective, being involved in the trail planning process in Tillamook, but also specifically, for example, this summer we had a very important bridge that needed to be reconstructed that was in a poorly designed environmentally sensitive area, poorly designed bridge, needed to be replaced, and we had the volunteers to do it, but we weren't able to get that done on a volunteer basis purely because of the coordination problems, staff availability. So that had to be built in-house with in-house operators and staff, and excellent but not cheap prison labor work, you know, which has been a great resource for us, but it's not free to supervise these crews. So, and further, as grant requests, we have our own state has an excellent off-highway vehicle funding program that my organization helped write this law that spends money on projects, and there are state federal trails programs, water quality enhancement grants that are unfortunately paperwork intensive processes, and it's a competitive process. So without the staff time to develop the grant requests, that money goes to whoever can produce those applications, and it's not only costly to write these grant requests, it's costly to administer them. So I can speak to the state grant program. It's specifically targeted to organizations that have a track record of excellent public support, user support, a track record of excellent grant administration and execution. And ODF in the Northwest Oregon area, in my experience anyway, is scores higher than anybody else that's applying for the grant money that I've come across. They, so to get to their, to get to that level, I'd just like to encourage that within their plan, they have the ability to continue to execute, but these are costs that will be offset through returns in volunteers and grant money, as well as being able to execute elements of the plan quickly that are out there. The use will continue to grow. The competing interests will continue to exist, but whether they're able to keep up and balance these interests is really an issue with the funding. Finally, as a small woodland owner, I do want to throw a pitch in for Service Forester. It's just a huge program. This is the public face of the Oregon Department of Forestry, and with the incredibly diverse ownership across the state in small woodlands and the diverse experience levels, I don't think you can calculate the costs in compliance problems, enforcement, and just literal compliance and compliance enforcement. The costs of eliminating that Service Forester program, and I know it's always a tenuous issue in the budget, and I want to encourage you to do what you can in that regard. So, barring any questions, I'll wrap it up.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I was intrigued to hear you say that you've been riding motorcycles in the state forest for 20 years, which gives you a pretty good set of reference points. Could you comment at all about any differences that you've noticed in road construction or in road maintenance in any of the state forests over that two-decade period?
Road, vehicle road mm-hmm. construction and maintenance?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's actually a course of 37 years. So, I mean, initially what comes to mind is that the area I'm most exposed with, the Tillamook Forest, hasn't been a harvest production forest until recently. So roads, this may not be the heart of your question, but the roads that were a little more than trails are now servicing roads, you know, so their road construction exists to access the operations that now are increasing out there.
What I'm really trying to speak to, maybe I can make it easier for Mr. Brown by putting a little finer point on my question. I've been on and off of both publicly owned and managed timberlands as well as privately, and it strikes me that the road construction on some of the private lands is quite serviceable for its intended purpose. It's pit run, but it's quite serviceable for log trucks and the kind of vehicles that you would expect to see off-road in more remote areas. On some of the state lands that I've been on, the roads are practically as smooth as downtown streets. They're groomed to a point that you could drive a very low-slung urban sedan vehicle on it. And while I understand the competing challenge of trying to make public lands as appropriate accessible to folks, I'm wondering about the wisdom in these budget times of huge expenditures in these finely groomed roads in state-owned forests, and at what monstrous expense when it might suffice to simply say, dear public, if you're going to drive on these roads, don't bring your low-slung Chevy, bring a pickup or a vehicle that's appropriate to be in the woods. And I just wondered if you had any comment based on your experience of riding vehicles in and around state-owned forests.
I can say that from my involvement in the recreation planning and processes, we, the recreation staff that I work with and us users are trying to advocate for roads that become put to bed if they are not actually needed for public transportation. If they're access roads, they should not be engineered to highway standards, as you describe. I'm sure there are a host of liability issues and that I'm not aware of that one might argue for those kind of expenses, but to an extent, I agree with you. There are some nice roads out there.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Sir?
My name's Wayne Nalen, and like Barrett, I'm on the State Forest Advisory Committee, and I got involved in the Tillamook State Forest as a trail construction volunteer about 3.5 years ago, representing Portland United Mountain Peddlers, and I also represent the International Mountain Biking Association. So I'm coming here today, and politics makes strange bedfellows, but I, too, am also advocating very strongly for no reduction, and I would even like to see an increase in recreation budget for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And a couple of things that Barrett said are true for my user group, too. And who I represent are non-motorized trail users. That's mountain bikers, which I am, and the club I represent. But I also represent horseback riders and hikers. And like Barrett was saying, we have a large volunteer workforce for non-motorized trails, too. But like his situation, we can't do it without ODF personnel to map those trails, mark those trails, and to work with on the design of those trails. And then we can take our volunteer crews and put these new trails in. But that's what I'm here to advocate for, is non-motorized trails and the leadership from ODF to make those trails happen, because we have some really great trails planned in the Tillamook State Forest and hopefully very soon in the Clatsop State Forest. We can provide a lot of labor and a lot of sweat. What we can't do are several critical things that we need ODF recreation personnel to do. Some of those are applying for grants, and like with Barrett's trails, which are motorized trails, we also depend on the South Fork prison crew, God bless those convicts, to help us build those trails. And that's what I'm here to advocate for. I would like to end my comments by saying that I think this is money that's really well spent by ODF. I think in terms of public relations, what the people in the metropolitan area really notice is being able to access the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest, and that means trails, and that's what they're looking for. And I think money spent on trails is really going to pay off. Maybe it'd be less lawsuits. It could be in a whole bunch of areas, both literally in terms of dollars, but also in goodwill, to keep a high focus and a high commitment to non-motorized trails in the Tillamook. And like you were saying, we like rough roads. We like it even better when, of course, there's no roads there at all. And I have a city sedan that has about 1.5 inches of road clearance. And, you know, I always like roads that are really rough, because then you get out of the car and you ride your bike. to the trailhead. So we are not big supporters of roads. We don't support kiosks. And although we like campgrounds, you know, we don't need them. You know, we can go out there and camp out without a campground. You know, we're really, the people I represent are very, very focused. What we see for recreation is we want ODF personnel, ODF recreation people, and trails. Everything else would be gravy, but our focus is very clear on the non-motorized trails that have been planned, that we're able to go ahead and actually build those. Thanks. Any comments?
Any other comments, questions? I just can't miss this opportunity to inquire from both of you fellows. I have a couple of partners on timberland, and I owned with my family prior to coming to this. And there's a situation that bothers me a lot because it reflects negatively on the property owners as well as on other users such as yourselves. And that is that we as timberland owners work very hard to get our water bars in, to slope the roads, to culvert, and the whole thing. We check our roads two or three times a winter to make sure that everything's functioning properly and doing the right job. And yet oftentimes when we're driving back home, we see four-wheelers with mud from one end of the car to the other. And I'm not suggesting that they're members of your organization. I'm positive they're not. But it does make it difficult for other users. As a matter of fact, we've been forced to lock our gates simply because they were tearing our roads up. And I have to wonder, where are they doing this? They're either doing it on federal or state lands or on other private landowners, but I know that even some of the public and private forests are being locked up for that very reason. I guess what I'm asking is if you, I'm sure you folks have talked about this, because again, as I said, it does reflect on everyone. It makes it harder for everyone to have access to the forest. But if your organizations have had any thoughts on how do we, as a society, manage this and get it back under control?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you took the time to bring it up. We have a very active statewide organization, and on my timberland, I have gates with locks on them. I mean, and I'm a motorized user. The gains. I might as well take up knitting. If we cut the budget of management efforts like Oregon Department of Forestry and so on, we will not be selling motorized dirt bikes or four wheelers and even mountain bikes for that matter without proper management. Let me give you an example. We have a historic trail. It happens to be located next to a key salmon anchor habitat right in a riparian area, several miles long. And it's poorly designed, but it's been there for years, so it's a lot of love for that trail. And any bike that goes in that trail comes out a couple miles at the other end covered in mud. And did we need to have an environmental organization sue the department to have that trail closed? No, we didn't. The motorcycling community participated in the decision to close that trail, and we didn't need to sue to keep it open. We participated in the decision to close that trail because the staff, our users have the confidence in the staff to live up to their promise to relocate that trail. Even if we could argue that we could harden that trail and fix it so it wasn't really an environmental problem, but it's still contrary to the spirit of riparian management, and it's a black eye on our sport. And a big part of what ODF does is administer enforcement efforts that we, in fact, our community pays for three deputy sheriffs in the Tillamook State Forest to deal with the people you're talking about who are riding outside of designated areas. And so that's what the recreation component and the recreation planning component of this budget is all about, is management, aggressive management, and they have the full support of the organized users. There are a lot of people with those four-wheelers and those three-wheelers and those motorcycles in the back of pickups that we wish would take up knitting. And Because they're not dedicated to the sport. It could be just as well be some other toy that it's the organized user, and we can reach many of them, but we can't carry badges and we can't do enforcement. And so those without those enforcement dollars, that's one other leg that gets pulled out from under the table. And after that recreation component fails, then the next component fails, public confidence in the plan fails. That's very important.
I appreciate what you said about enforcement. I do think there's another aspect, and we've seen this in wildlife, for example, where the community and peer pressure through reporting violations and those kind of things. Now, I would never suggest that anyone out in the forest take it upon themselves.
If I may,
simply,
part of this budget is to administer a volunteer trail patrol program in the Tillamook State Forest, where we do wear vests and educate users. And that program, in fact, as we speak, has been backburnered because of it's a volunteer coordination problem, and do that very thing.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time. We don't have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone in the audience who elected to sign up that would like to testify? Not. Mr. Wu, would you like to see what we can accomplish in the next 45 minutes? You have some material I think you handed out today, right?
That's correct, Chair Meserle. Chair Meserle and members of the committee, want to just close up on yesterday's conversation regarding what was the policy conversation regarding the Elliott State Forest and with the land board. Just quickly, the reason I brought up the forest practices, the points that I made yesterday, is that when it comes to the federal ESA, the private landowners and state lands are under the either the take avoidance strategy or we apply for one of the options for a take permit. And I think the piece that I want to also highlight is that far as the risk, it is risk management in terms of the federal ESA, and that in terms of private lands, our experience is that the habitat conditions has a lot to do with the risks in terms of how we've managed the the Endangered Species Act. And I would close in terms of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, the Oregon Forest Practices Act is a good forest policy. And also, as I concluded yesterday about the greatest permanent value of administrative rule on Board of Forestry, and in the handouts I believe that you have, as the board completed the forest management plan, it actually developed a set of findings and also a set of intent statements, I believe, as Representative Krieger mentioned yesterday. And I think the point that I want to make on those handouts, and the reason I even bring them up, is that they are, in fact, if you want direction from the Board of Forestry to the department as we implement the forest management plan. So, as acting state forester last month, I approved the implementation plans for the districts. And the note that I would like to point out is that in that implementation plans, or in those implementation plans, there were significant work plans in them, such as work with the counties in harvest modeling, completing the inventory, and finding every opportunity to increase that level of harvest. And at the same time, the department, myself, has made a commitment to keep the harvest or maintain that harvest at the very high end of the 10-year implementation plan, which I approved last month. Also, in terms of work plan, was the monitoring and the adaptive management work plan in the IPs. And the significance of those is that we want to do the very best science analysis and assessment of our practices out there and look for opportunities to make modification and adaptive changes as we learn more about what we're doing in the forest. And we're committed in working with both the counties and any other interest group that is willing to work with us on those work plans and those IPs.
Mr. Chair. President Morgan.
I'm curious about the statement that you make about being able to be able to take advantage of new science and new processes and just new information that comes onto the table with relation to the implementation of an HCP. And what I'm curious about is once you've got the HCP in place, how cast in concrete are you at that point? What's involved in if you, for instance, if there was a successful delisting of the coho, how would you adjust the HCP to allow for that? Would that be another great protracted negotiating process with our federal partners? What would we get?
If I may, Representative Morgan and Chair Merrily and Committee, I'd like to defer that question to
he just left, right?
No, he didn't. I saw him.
or okay.
We got volunteers.
Chair Mesley, Representative Morgan.
Have you got their car keys too?
Chair Mesley, Representative Morgan. Other members of the committee. I'm Ross Holloway. I'm the director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry, and have been primarily involved in working with the services on various HCPs. Every HCP is different. In relation to the question about delisting, we do have an opt-out clause in the Elliott HCP, which could be employed in the case of a delisting, depending on which species was delisted there.
What do you mean by an opt-out clause? What exactly is that?
Either party can terminate the HCP agreement with certain notice. In the case of a delisting, normally in HCP, an opt-out clause, you have to mitigate for any incidental take that occurred during the time you had the HCP in place. I'm speculating now, but with a delisting, the issue of incidental take would no longer be there because that's only in the context of a listed species. But I think beyond that, each HCP does have an implementing agreement that the parties construct to address issues of additional species that become listed after the HCP is adopted if they're not included, as well as provisions if you want to include them for species delistings.
And so in the, if I might, Mr. Chair, in the HCP that you're negotiating, our understanding is that it is a multi-species HCP. What are the discussion points right now about things that become delisted or downlisted?
Chairman Hensley, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, it's a very complex legal document that the solicitor with the services and our attorney general are working on at this point. There's approximately 20 species we're considering for the Elliott HCP. We're not sure we'll include them all in the end. If a particular species is delisted, the service basically works with the party to evaluate, well, what specific parts of that HCP were designed to provide for that species, and can they be modified? It's an amendment is what it would be to the HCP at that point. The strategies in these things are pretty integrated. So a particular strategy to provide acres of a certain type of timber, for instance, might be there for several different species. So the delisting of merely one may or may not influence a particular strategy in the HCP.
So if I might, Mr. Chair, then there is no certainty about what would happen. There's no cut and dry process in place. Everything would be renegotiated. Is that what I hear you saying?
Chair Mesley, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, there is no complete certainty. That's true. It would be a negotiated process based on the specific strategies and how they were described as protecting or providing for those individual species. That's
and
correct.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
On the converse of that situation, if there were species that are currently not listed and they were listed, would then we be in a renegotiating process too?
Chair Mesley, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, that too is an implementing agreement issue. There are HCPs, a particular landowner in Washington,
NHCP, where a number of species were on the incidental take permit, which means you have full coverage. They had other species listed in the HCP that were not on the permit and were subsequently added to the permit when they were listed, because the HCP had strategies that provided for them. The specific example in Washington was bull trout, subsequently listed and then added to the permit without any additional strategies. But that's the way they can be constructed to operate.
May I have
one more?
So I'm not clearly getting what you're saying here. So if there are species that are added after the HCP is finalized, you have essentially no guarantee that you're going to be able to have the HCP cover them at each juncture that this happens? You have a negotiating process with essentially an unknown outcome?
I'm Chair Meserly, Representative Morgan, and members of the committee. If those species are listed as, quote, covered species in the HCP, but they're not currently federally listed as threatened or endangered, the process to add them is much simpler than if you didn't address them at all in the HCP and then they were subsequently listed. And that's the example I made from Washington, where they had described bull trout in the HCP but not asked to have them on the incidental take permit. And the subsequent adding of bull trout to that incidental take permit was an exchange of letters between the company and the services without additional negotiation and strategy. So it depends on the original HCP, and I think of the 20 species we're considering on the Elliott, only three or four are currently listed as threatened or endangered. The rest are sensitive, and we don't want to get in a situation where they're subsequently listed and we didn't have some measures in place to address them.
Mr. Chair, I think just a statement then, because from what I'm hearing, I don't see that you get a lot of certainty with an HCP. That, you know, I think you have you're springing from a bigger pool, so you've got more things covered, but you have no certainty that if you add to the pool or take away from the pool, that you aren't going to be back in a negotiating or a litigation situation. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, Chair Meserly, Representative Morgan, and members of the committee, the less species that you cover and address in your HCP, the higher that risk is. There are HCPs in Washington where they have over 200 species covered, and so their risk is very low that an additional listing is going to impact their operations.
And the trade-off, if the more species you have covered, the more land you have to set aside from production, or the more measures you have to have in place to mitigate for any environmental impacts. Is that a true statement?
Chair Meserly, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, it's different in every HCP, and I don't know that the large landowners in Washington with 200-plus species would necessarily say that. A lot of the strategies for the major species of concern provide habitat for these other sensitive species, or other species, even if they're not sensitive. So it all depends on what species you have and what their specific habitat needs are. But I think largely the Allen Merlet strategies and riparian strategies in place under some of those HCPs do indeed provide for many other species without any additional measures in place.
But
they're designed for those particular species and provide for others as well.
But no guarantees?
No absolute guarantees.
But are you going to let me talk?
Well, our good senator has.
No, I was going to say she's doing fine. Okay. I'll just pick up where she leaves off.
She's conceded her time. Go ahead.
Well, no. Nice try.
Will you indulge me?
Sure.
I want to kind of change gears because in previous testimony, we heard that there was a report that came out, two reports that came out, one that by Rasmussen that verified a report by Sessions that didn't appear from the testimony that we had to support the HCP premise. And I'm just curious about what happened within the agency with relation to those two reports and where you are now in the way that you're planning for ESA issues on the Elliott.
Well, Chair Mesrilli, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, the reports referred to were for Northwest Oregon State Forest lands and not the Elliott State Forest.
Oh, okay.
And the model runs made by Dr. Sessions, we made model runs incorporating anticipated HCP strategies and model runs that didn't, that operated under a take avoidance scenario. We believe those model runs demonstrated the benefits of having an HCP. And in fact, the model run often referred to that the board endorsed the assumptions of in implementing the plan included anticipation of an HCP over time in order to carry out those strategies. And that model run returned higher levels of harvest than runs made that reflected doing take avoidance over the long term and the additional encumbrances that that would bring.
I'm confused here. And could you kind of back me up and take me through again, talk about the report that was written by Sessions and then the report that was done by Rasmussen, and then how that factored into what ended up actually happening in the forest planning issues.
Chair Mesrilli, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, the original work done by Dr. John Sessions was harvest schedule modeling work with new technology that he had developed at Oregon State University.
With relation to the Tillamook?
With relation to the North Coast planning area in the forest, primarily the Clatsop and Tillamook forests, okay. were the main body of lands analyzed. That was modeling done in the final year prior to plan adoption. The purpose of that modeling was to compare the different alternatives that were available to the board in terms of their decision space, from a fairly intensive production type model of forest management all the way to sort of a reserve based approach to forest management. Our approach that we had developed and proposed was also modeled, and again with and without these HCP strategies.
So these were two divergent approaches that were being evaluated at the same time.
There was an array of forest management approaches looked at in the modeling. I think we ran seven different alternatives, and then we started to run variations on those alternatives to test different assumptions and to move different parameters around. And it was that modeling effort that resulted or demonstrated the balance of resource values, if you will, that the board determined represented greatest permanent value. And then the particular model run that the board adopted the assumptions of and the principles of was alternative 1C2, and they've heard reference to it in other conversations. And the volume, a certain volume was projected by that model run. In preparing our implementation plans, they didn't reflect that full volume, and there's a variety of reasons for that, part of which was inventory issues.
And this was a state land board decision?
Chair Mesrilli, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, no, this was a Board of Forestry decision in adopting the forest management plan. And if you look at the intent statements that are in the handout before you, you'll see there's some references in there to that particular model run, and the assumptions that went into that model run were to be applied on the ground in developing the implementation plans, which the state forester approved last month.
And that's this document?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've always been a supporter of multi-species HCPs, but Representative Morgan raises some interesting questions. How many species are you negotiating for on the Tillamook Clatsop HCP?
Chair Mesrilli, Senator Dukes, and members of the committee, currently the list we have in the draft, I believe, is 20, 25 or 26 different species, several of which are listed: northern spotted owl, marbled murrelet, salmonids, coho.
The other species that aren't listed, do we believe that they're close to the numbers that could get them listed, or are they just growing in the forest and we like them, so we want to make sure they stay there?
Chair Mesrilli, Senator Dukes, members of the committee, we went through a process, our own biologists working with Department of Fish and Wildlife biologists, to look at the entire list of known terrestrial aquatic species and determine or come to basically it was a risk assessment. You know, what is the current status of these species? Do they exist on these lands? And what is the likelihood that a given species could be listed
in the period of a habitat conservation plan, and that's where they came up with this from 250 plus species down to this 25 that I referred to.
So could be listed in the next 50 to 60 years? Is that?
That was the parameter we used, since that would be the term of the permit under the HCP.
Okay, would you give me a list of what all those species are and indicate which ones are listed today? And I appreciate that if somebody can. Thank you.
Yes, we can do that.
Roy's nodding. And then I have some. Oh, also, what to follow up on Representative Morgan's questions. If you missed one, I mean, one of those other 200 and some species comes along, and she was talking about deleting, but what if you were to add? I'm assuming that for each one of these 25 or 26 species, you're looking at what it needs to exist and to be healthy. And for fish, you know, that's a certain number of things. For owls and murrelets, it's something else. So that I generally make the assumption, although it's not, generally speaking, a completely good assumption, that for each one of those, you've added something. I learned that with violets, you need, you know, different things than you need for the murrelets. So if you wanted to add another one, what if it didn't have the plan you had didn't have protections, but suddenly the federal government or the state decides that we've got a new flower and it needs to, you know, there isn't enough of them, or a new frog and it needs to be protected. Would you then likely end up opening that HCP for negotiations?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, and members of the committee, It depends on this particular species and its habitat needs. And for instance, many of the aquatic and riparian related species, their needs are all met by a similar set of strategies that protects water quality and provides inputs for those habitats.
But if it were a flower or a mushroom or something like that, it wouldn't necessarily be covered.
That's correct. If a very niche specific species that you did not have a protection in place for, there's a potential, I think it's minimized by an integrated sort of set of strategies that provides the array of habitats that were historically out there, and that's the basic premise of the forest management plan, is to do that.
Okay, so would you...
I might add, though, you know, when you bring up things like mushrooms and plants and that sort of thing, we deal with those... I'm sorry, Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester. As Ross mentioned, some of those are very niche-located species, and we can just kind of draw a little circle around the 3 acres of the plants, and we wouldn't go through an HCP process. It would only be if it, you know, impacted our lands on a broader scale basis would we do that. And that's where you see the owls and murrelets tend to be a much broader scale and many more acres impacted. So, I mean, as Ross mentioned, there could be an issue where something gets listed. We have plants that are currently listed that are on our property, but they don't result in us going after an HCP because, again, it's just a risk assessment.
You don't necessarily know that those plants or fungus are going to be in one specific area. A lot of the plants that you have are throughout the forest, but they may not be in large enough numbers to manage. So I'm just curious what the process would be, because we're looking at the HCP as giving us some surety that we can harvest and do certain things, do carry out the management plan. And it's sounding as though, yeah, I don't know, though, they're managing for a whole lot of species here, so maybe they're covering enough of them to make us comfortable. Mr. Chair, I have some questions that relates to the handout they gave us, some specific ones on the management plan.
Go ahead.
Can I? Thank you. I was curious, on page one, the board is talking about retaining options for future policymakers and for the citizens in Oregon. And then it says, in the event that they decide to adjust the policy direction for state forests, what exactly were they talking about? What kind of leeway are they trying to protect for the future?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, which document are you referring to?
It says Board of Forestry intent statement on adopting the Northwest and Southwest Forest Management. It was handed to us today. It says number one on that page. And buried in the middle of it is that they were preserving it.
in the event that they, which would be us, I guess, and you guys, in the event that they decide to adjust the policy direction for state forests, it's an unusual thing for a state agency to adopt policies that allow for a change of policies in the future. Usually we think we got it when we adopt them. So I was curious as to what the board was trying to preserve for in the future.
Senator Mesley, or Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, and members of the committee, as I recall the discussion on that with the board was making a statement that they felt that the forest management plan and its desired future condition that it describes and proposes to move towards was one that would leave a lot of options open for future generations, for future decision makers in the state, if other goals or objectives, you know, became available in the future, if people wanted to pursue them, that it was a plan that created and left options open rather than closing options off through some other through the application of some other strategic approach.
I'm going to be blunt, and let me see if I'm where they are. I'm assuming that this means, in case we want to turn this forest into a state park in the future, that we would have enough standing timber left and enough interesting species that we would be able to do that. Am I correct?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, members of the committee, I don't believe you are in terms of the board's intent at the time. That was not part of their discussion at the time. Representative Krieger's not here today, but he was a member of that board that went through that discussion, so you might.
Then can you give me some hint as to what kind of options they thought we needed to protect for the future?
If I may, Chair Mesley and Senator Dukes and committee, I think, as I understand, number one here is in adopting the forest management plan, the Board of Forestry is hoping that in defining a pathway toward the desired future condition that's identified in the plan, that in that context, that there will be a broader options. I know that discussion among the board was they want to provide a context in the planning that it would, and for the future, it would provide more options as opposed to providing a context in the plan that would, in fact, bring them to a narrower, broader array of options. So the way I read it and the way I understand the board's action was that it has to be put in the context of defining the way we define the pathway toward desired future condition. And so the example of going toward a state park was not a desired future condition because of all the social and economic needs that also has to be part of this greatest permanent value. So greatest permanent value, if you will, the way it is constructed, trumps the state park scenario as a future option.
Can you give me the statutory quote, where the greatest permanent value, what statute has that language?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, I believe it's in ORS 530-010. It's the parent statute for Board of Forestry lands.
It's 530.050.
Oh, is that where the actual greatest permanent value?
Yes,
is
the actual. That's
thank
short
you.
I try to anticipate these kind of questions.
That's good. Well, I hope you anticipated page 3 then.
if I may, also in Division 35, the administrative rule is actually the detailed language of the greatest permanent value, and certainly we'll have copies for you. Sorry.
I find administrative rules very interesting, but I always like to go back to the statute to see if you did what we meant. Page 3. It says that the Board of Forestry finds that the management practices that flow from the implementation of this plan will pursue compatibility of forest uses over time. Can you tell me what that means?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, and members of the committee, that term, compatibility of forest uses, appears in the administrative rules that Roy Wu just referred to.
Maybe I need a copy of the administrative rules, because I know it always does.
And the board's definition in those rules says compatibility means capable of existing or operating together in harmony
And the converse that I think that the board discussed at the time was the concept of zoning uses apart, so that if one use was going on in a particular place in the forest, other uses could not. So the concept was one of integration of uses, several uses that being able to occur on the forest in a given place rather than separating them
so apart. That the mountain bikers might be mountain biking in another portion of the forest while the timber harvest is going on?
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, we hope they're mountain biking there when the timber harvest is going on in the general area. Oh, obviously not in the operation itself.
I wouldn't put it
not in the operation itself, but in the general area that goes on right now all the time.
And it says another one of the pieces in that was achieve site-specific goals for forest resources. And a lot of these are plural, and it's not something I'm familiar with when we're talking state forest lands, that we're talking plural. And I understand, I think I understand some of the plurality, and I'm trying to get to it. I mean, we've had recreational uses in the state forests for, well, the folks who were testifying told us how long they've been in there, a long, long time. And we've always encouraged it. So when we talk about site-specific goals for forest resources, what are we talking about?
You can answer that?
Yes, please.
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, members of the committee. I believe that the board's intent there was a reference to there are certain uses that, if they're going to exist, do have to exist fairly exclusively on a given acre. And probably a good example is a campground, where we have a campground. We just don't have a lot of the other resource uses going on because they're not compatible on that specific site. So another example would be something like a spotted owl nest area.
Okay.
And so that pretty much precludes other uses in that small site.
Yeah, I'm trying, and I'm having great difficulty. And it's the forest department has been wonderful in trying to help me. So it's got to be me. I thought I had a pretty good handle on the Forest Practices Act, and now the new management plan is slowly starting to make some sense to me. But what I'm having trouble getting a handle on is how these all interrelate, because there seem to be so many different pieces. For example, we're digging further into the management plan, but at the same time, from the governor's office today, I got something that it's an agreement on a part of the Tillamook class of forest that, if you go to the last page, says that the proposal quadruples the no-harvest buffer on all fish-bearing streams and medium and large non-fish-bearing streams from 25 to 100 feet, and that the agreement doubles the no-harvest buffer on seasonal non-fish-bearing streams from 25 to 50 feet on high-energy and debris torrent streams. And they're doing this for 7 of the 9 healthiest stocks in the region. So we're not, I mean, and there's a certain amount of sense to that. You want to keep the healthy ones healthy. But it's a different perspective from managing for the weakest stocks. And I can't get a handle on how these all interrelate and overlay is what I'm struggling with at the moment. I'm not saying that any of them are bad. I just, it seems like every time I turn around, we're doing something because of a different reason. And if I could corral all those reasons into one thing, then I could maybe try to understand how we're managing the forest. So that's just my frustration at the moment. That wasn't a question.
Well, Chair Mesley and Senator Dukes and the committee, I think it's a good question. Believe me, as we were developing this process and going through it, and I'll speak for myself and not for all my staff, I mean, we struggled with this, you know, where all the pieces fit in and how does it work and link to each other. And I would like to refer to Ted Lawrenson to address your question.
And I didn't honestly mean it as a question. I was trying to explain to the chair that maybe before we get finished with all this, I won't have quite as much confusion.
Chair Mesley, Senator Dukes, members of the committee, let me give it a try. I've been engaged in the Forest Practices Program for years, and I would agree it is an outstanding Forest Practices Act. But as any point of protection, there's a range of marginal benefits and costs, and as an easy example of why the range is, you might see the different perspectives. We know in terms of relationships where riparian functions come from, you can quantify them in terms of distance from the stream, and we know the relative proportion of those functions in that context. For example, within 50 foot of a stream, probably about 70% of all riparian function in terms of large wood are provided. But to get to 100% of large wood function, you've got to go out to the maximum tree height, and there's a real diminishing curve there. And so it's a measure of risk and input. And from the forest practice that perspective, we're just directed to provide for economically efficient forest practices. So we've made a decision in the context of what the landowner ought to provide, that it ought to be done in an efficient way, but it's not 100% of riparian function necessarily. It may well be. We don't have any monitoring to show one way or the other, but we know it's a pretty big proportion of the function. It's not all of it. On a landscape basis, given the disturbance regimes, that kind of stuff, it probably represents a big portion of it, though. And there's a factor of time as well in the sense of how restoration and mitigation occurs. If you have, say, 60 to 70 or 90, 95% of riparian functions being provided, and you're trying to mitigate from past impacts, the rate of mitigation may be relatively different if you're leaving a 50-foot buffer, or a 100-foot buffer, or a 200-foot buffer. And so those are sort of decisions that go into the process, and the state forest lands have made some choices in anticipation of what their role is in an array of habitat conditions that are also associated with aquatic habitats. Their relative contribution in terms of mitigation for choices we made in the past and that sort of thing. So we can array things out in terms of where functions come from. In the state of Washington, the state of California, in the context of their forest practices programs, have made some different decisions on riparian protection. They actually, in the state of Washington, provide protections that are fairly similar to what state forest lands are doing. Those are hugely costly, and from our perspective on private lands, they're very inappropriate. In Washington, probably an average 20-21%, maybe more, of the private forest land is now off limited to riparian protection. They got a very small increment of protection for that additional impact, and it's driving land use conversions. Washington is losing about 80,000 acres of forest land to other uses per year. Oregon's losing less than 10% of that, or even smaller than that. So in the forest practices context, we look at what the landowners are appropriately required to meet in terms of overall maintenance of fish and wildlife in a landscape context from all the land uses, all the land's ownerships, and make some risk and cost-effective decisions. State forests have a different role, and that's looking at how functions are provided from that range of distance from streams. They've made some choices, and it's a perception of risk. And again, part of this is just a perception of risk, and there's different perceptions. There's no right answer, but clearly from the forest practices perspective, we have fairly explicit direction of economically efficient forest practices and overall maintenance of fish and wildlife. It's not maintenance of all fish and wildlife on all private lands. It's overall maintenance in the bigger scheme of things. State forests, in terms of their responsibility, as a landowner under the ESA, does have clearly some differences in terms of a landowner than we do as a regulator, and that shows up in terms of the different prescriptions that we see.
Dave, it's not actually what I was expressing my frustration on, but I appreciate that. You talk about choices, and I have to tell you that in the Platts of Tillamook, other than how we chose to replant that forest after the fires, we didn't make a lot of choices. Nature made choices, but we didn't, and so creating regulation based on choices that we made in the past in those two forests doesn't make a lot of sense. But no, my frustration was that I was trying to express to the chair and the other subcommittee members, we had this forest management plan, and it's supposed to control, and I'm narrowly only talking about the Platts of Tillamook at this point, but this does state lands, and now I have another piece and that was negotiated. And I understand that was negotiated and took a long time and not everybody was happy when they left. And now I'm looking at something else that's been negotiated out between Oregon Trout and Fish and Wildlife and Department of Forestry. And it impacts pieces of the same forest and it sort of overlays more regulation and more restrictions on that,
And I have noticed that somewhere buried in every one of these restrictive things is some notice that we're going to be able to keep the same amount of harvest. And I'm starting to wonder if we're going to be harvesting on the neighbor's land pretty soon, because I don't know how you do it with all of the restrictions. But my biggest concern is we've got people here today who want those trees when we cut them. We have people here today who want to enjoy those trees while they're growing. And so we have a whole lot of people interested in these forests. And how do they ever know what they can count on? If every time we turn around, we negotiate a new piece.
I think, Senator, a lot of us on this committee, if not all of us, are sharing the same misunderstanding or lack of understanding or lack of knowledge, but a frustration for sure. We're just about done with the committee, and I'd like to lay it out from where I see it as one member of this committee. And that is, I'm very troubled that we have, and I'm speaking mostly for the Elliott, but it would apply to the other state forests as well, somewhat. We're bound by law to manage the Elliott maximum return to the common school fund. We seem to have a difference of opinion in the route that the department is going with the HCPs, and what we've heard testimony from the private sector and organizations that are representing the broad spectrum of the private sector. I'm also troubled that some of those industrial owners operate in other states that we've been referenced as having successful HCP programs. Something's not fitting here. And I feel like, as a legislative committee member, we're kind of stuck in the middle and what's going on. In a case like this, and understanding that different people address different risks, but it just seems to me that there's, are we talking different language? Are we looking at different assumptions? We are very concerned about funding, maximum funding for our state government and our school systems. And I don't know if you want to respond to that now, Madam Speaker, if you have time. We've only got 2 or 3 minutes left.
Chair Messel and members of the committee, that is an important question, and I probably should bring you more information on this at a later time. But there is a fundamental difference why you're seeing different results in different states. And specifically for California, and a little less specific for Washington, under their Forest Practices Act, basically they have a permitting process where they generally cannot allow a forest operation to go forward if it results in a take under the federal ESA. So their standards under their Forest Practices Act eventually describe some form of take avoidance, and whereas our forest practices does not, it leaves that decision to the landowner, what they have to do to achieve take avoidance. We basically have a requirement, you've got to meet the Forest Practices Act. Our goals are different. In many cases, they end up having adequate protection under the Oregon Forest Practices Act. But Washington and California have fundamentally different Forest Practices Acts, and that results in some of the outcomes you're seeing being very different in terms of the HCP process. I would say that their system is much more messed up than ours is because of that, but it certainly doesn't leave the lack of complexity you're seeing here alone as well. It creates some other problems.
I appreciate what you're saying, Ted, don't get me wrong, but there's still a basic difference here that is not coming out yet that I can see. And from what you just said, that there are differences in the Forest Practices Act, I assume there's differences in the zoning laws to protect forest lands. But how does that lay out for what we have in Oregon, when participants in our state, between the department and the industry, see it differently? And what you said, I'm sure is absolutely. That still doesn't get to my concern of why are the different segments in the industry looking at it differently. I think with that, we've only got less than a minute left. I'd like to adjourn. What I plan on doing is we've instructed staff to start Monday with finishing up the Department of Forestry's budget, and then we will allot some time to the next budget that we'll be looking at next week as well. So appreciate everyone coming. Appreciate the public testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing.